Chapter 13. Bannon Agonistes. He, too, felt like a prisoner, he had told Katie Walsh when she came to tell him she was leaving. By 10 weeks in, Steve Bannon's mastery of the Trump agenda, or at least of Trump himself, appeared to have crumbled. His current misery was both Catholic in nature, the self-flagellation of a man who believed he lived on a higher moral plane than all others, and fundamentally misanthropic. As an antisocial, maladjusted, post-middle-aged man, he had to make a supreme effort to get along with others, an effort that often did not go well. Most especially, he was miserable because of Donald Trump, whose cruelties, always great even when they were casual, were unbearable when he truly turned against you. "I hated being on the campaign. I hated the transition. I hate being here in the White House," said Bannon, sitting one evening in Reince Priebus's office on an unseasonably warm evening in early spring, with the French doors open to the arbor-covered patio where he and Priebus, now firm friends and allies in their antipathy toward Jervanka, had set an outdoor table. But Bannon was, he believed, here for a reason. And it was his firm belief, a belief that he was unable to keep himself, thus continually undermining his standing with the president, that his efforts had brought everybody else here. Even more important, he was the only person showing up for work every day who was committed to the purpose of actually changing the country, changing it quickly, radically, and truly. The idea of a split electorate, of blue and red states, of two opposing currents of values, of globalists and nationalists, of an establishment and populist revolt, was media shorthand for cultural angst and politically roiled times, and to a large degree, for business as usual. But Bannon believed the split was literal. The United States had become a country of two hostile peoples. One would necessarily win and the other lose, or one would dominate while the other would become marginal. This was modern civil war, Bannon's war, the country built on the virtue and the character and the strength of the American working man circa 1955-65, was the ideal he meant to defend and restore. Trade agreements or trade wars that supported American manufacturing, immigration policies that protected American workers and, hence, American culture, or at least America's identity from 1955 to 1965, and an international isolation that would conserve American resources and choke off the ruling class's Davos sensibility, and also save working-class military lives. This was, in the view of almost everyone but Donald Trump and the alt-right, a crazy bit of voodoo economic and political nonsense, but it was, for Bannon, a revolutionary and religious idea. For most others in the White House, it was Bannon's pipe dream. "Steve is... Steve," became the gentle term of art for tolerating him. "A lot of stuff goes on in his head," said the president, pursuing one of his reliable conversational themes, dismissing Bannon. But it wasn't Bannon versus everybody else, so much as it was Bannon Trump versus non-Bannon Trump. If Trump, in his dark, determined, and aggressive mood, could respect Bannon and his views, he could just as easily represent nothing at all, or represent solely his own need for instant gratification. That's what the non-Bannon people understood about Trump. If the boss was happy, then a normal, incremental, two steps forward, one step back approach to politics might prevail. Even a new sort of centrism, as inimical to Bannonism as it was possible to conceive, could emerge. Bannon's pronouncements about a 50-year rule for Trumpism might then be supplanted by the rule of Jared, Ivanka, and Goldman Sachs. By the end of March, this was the side that was winning. Bannon's efforts to use the epic healthcare fail as evidence that the establishment was the enemy had hopelessly backfired. Trump saw the healthcare failure as his own failure, but since he didn't have failures, it couldn't be a failure, and it would in fact be a success, if not now, soon. So Bannon, a Cassandra on the sidelines, was the problem. Trump rationalized his early embrace of Bannon by heaping scorn on him and by denying that he had ever embraced him. If there was anything wrong with his White House, it was Steve Bannon. Maligning Bannon was Trump's idea of fun. When it came to Bannon, Trump rose to something like high analysis. Steve Bannon's problem is PR. He doesn't understand it. Everybody hates him because, look at him, his bad PR rubs off on other people. The real question, of course, was how Bannon, the fuck-the-system populist, had ever come to think that he might get along with Donald Trump, the use-the-system-to-his-own-advantage billionaire. For Bannon, Trump was the game he had to play. But in truth, he hardly played it, or couldn't help undermining it. While ever proclaiming it Trump's victory, he would helplessly point out that when he had joined the campaign, it was facing a polling deficit that no campaign 10 weeks from Election Day had ever recovered from. Trump without Bannon, according to Bannon, was Wendell Willkie. Bannon understood the necessity not to take what otherwise might be Trump's own spotlight. He was well aware that the president meticulously logged all claims against credit that he believed solely to be his. Both he and Kushner, the two most important figures in the White House after the president, seemed professionally mute. Still, Bannon seemed to be everywhere, and the president was convinced, rightly, that it was the result of Bannon's private press operation. More often than self-mockery could sustain, Bannon referred to himself as President Bannon. A bitter Kellyanne Conway, regularly dissed for her own spotlight grabbing, confirmed the president's observation that Bannon stepped into as many White House photo ops as possible. Everybody seemed to keep count of everybody else's photobombs. Bannon also did not much bother to disguise his innumerable blind quotes, nor to make much of an effort to temper his not-so-private slurs against Kushner, Cohn, Powell, Conway, Priebus, and even the president's daughter, often most especially the president's daughter. Curiously, Bannon never expressed a sideways thought about Trump. Not yet. Trump's own righteousness and soundness was perhaps too central to Bannon's construct of Trumpism. Trump was the idea you had to support. This could seem to approach the traditional idea of respecting the office. In fact, it was the inverse. The man was the vessel. There was no Bannon without Trump. However much he might stand on his unique, even magical-seeming contributions to the Trump victory, Bannon's opportunity was wholly provided by Trump's peculiar talent. He was no more than the man behind the man, Trump's Cromwell, as he put it, even though he was perfectly aware of Cromwell's fate. But his loyalty to the idea of Trump hardly protected him from the actual Trump's constant briefs against him. The president had assembled a wide jury to weigh Bannon's fate, putting before it, in an insulting Borscht Belt style, a long list of Bannon's annoyances. "Guy looks homeless. Take a shower, Steve. You've worn those pants for 6 days. He says he's made money. I don't believe it." The president, notably, never much took issue with Bannon's policy views. The Trump administration was hardly 2 months old, yet every media outlet was predicting Bannon's coming defenestration. One particularly profitable transaction with the president was to bring him new, ever harsher criticism of his chief strategist, or reports of other people criticizing him. It was important to know not to say anything positive to Trump about Bannon. Even faint praise before the butt, Steve is obviously smart, but, could produce a scowl and pout if you didn't hurry to the butt. Then again, saying anyone was smart invariably incurred Trump's annoyance. Kushner enlisted Scarborough and Brzezinski in something of a regular morning television Bannon slagathon. H.R. McMaster, the three-star general who had replaced Michael Flynn as national security advisor, had secured the president's pledge that he could veto members of the NSC. Kushner, a supporter of McMaster's appointment, had quickly ensured that Dina Powell, a key player in the Kushner faction, would join the NSC and Bannon would be removed. Bannonites would, with lowered voices and certain pity, ask each other how he seemed and how he was holding up. Invariably, they would agree about how bad he looked, the strain etching ever deeper into his already ruined face. David Bossie thought Bannon looked like he would die. "I now understand what it is like to be in the court of the Tudors," reflected Bannon. On the campaign trail, he recalled, Newt Gingrich would come with all these dumb ideas. When we won, he was my new best friend. Every day, 100 ideas. When, by spring, in the White House, I got cold, when I went through my valley of death, I saw him one day in the lobby, and he looks down, avoiding my eyes, with a kind of mumbled, "Hey, Steve." And I say, "What are you doing here? Let's get you inside." And he says, No, I'm fine. I'm waiting for Dina Powell." Having attained the unimaginable, bringing a fierce alt-right anti-liberal ethno-populism into a central place in the White House, Bannon found himself face to face with the untenable, undermined by, and having to answer to, rich, entitled Democrats. The paradox of the Trump presidency was that it was both the most ideologically driven and the least. It represented a deeply structural assault on liberal values. Bannon's deconstruction of the administrative state meant to take with it media, academic, and not-for-profit institutions. But from the start, it also was apparent that the Trump administration could just as easily turn into a country club Republican or a Wall Street Democrat regime, or just a constant effort to keep Donald Trump happy. Trump had his collection of pet peeve issues test-marketed in various media rollouts and mega-rallies, but none seemed so significant as his greater goal of personally coming out ahead of the game. As the drumbeat for Bannon's removal grew, the Mercers stepped in to protect their investment in radical government overthrow and the future of Steve Bannon. In an age when all successful political candidates are surrounded by, if not at the beck and call of, difficult rich people pushing the bounds of their own power, and the richer they were, the more difficult they might be, Bob and Rebecca Mercer were quite unto themselves. If Trump's ascent was unlikely, the Mercers was all the more so. Even the difficult rich, the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson on the right, David Geffen and George Soros on the left, are leavened and restrained by the fact that money exists in a competitive market. Obnoxiousness has its limits. The world of the rich is, in its fashion, self-regulating. Social climbing has rules. But among the difficult and entitled rich, the Mercers cut a path through disbelief and incredulity. Unlike other people contributing vast sums to political candidates, they were willing not to win, ever. Their bubble was their bubble. So when they did win by the fluke alignment of the stars for Donald Trump, they were yet pure. Now, having found themselves, by odds that were perfect storm outlandish, in power, they were not going to give it up because Steve Bannon had hurt feelings and wasn't getting enough sleep. Toward the end of March, the Mercers organized a set of emergency meetings. At least one of them was with the president himself. It was exactly the kind of meeting Trump usually avoided. He had no interest in personnel problems, since they put the emphasis on other people. Suddenly, he was being forced to deal with Steve Bannon, rather than the other way around. What's more, it was a problem he had in part created with his constant Bannon dissing, and now he was being asked to eat crow. Even though the president kept saying he could and should fire Bannon, he was aware of the costs, a right-wing backlash of unpredictable proportions. Trump thought the Mercers were super strange bedfellows. He didn't like Bob Mercer looking at him and not saying a word. He didn't like being in the same room with Mercer or his daughter. But though he refused to admit that the Mercers' decision to back him and their imposition of Bannon on the campaign in August was likely the event without which he would not now be in the White House, he did understand that if crossed, the Mercers and Bannon were potential world-class troublemakers. The complexity of the Bannon-Mercer problem prompted Trump to consult two contradictory figures, Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes. Even as the president did so, perhaps he knew he would come up with a zero-sum answer. Murdoch, already briefed by Kushner, said getting rid of Bannon was the only way to deal with the dysfunction in the White House. Murdoch, of course, made the assumption that getting rid of Kushner was not an option. It was the inevitable outcome, so do it now. Murdoch's response made perfect sense. By now, he had become an active political supporter of the Kushner-Goldman moderates, seeing them as the people who would save the world from Bannon and indeed from Trump as well. Ailes, blunt and declarative as always, said, "Donald, you can't do it. You've made your bed and Steve is in it. You don't have to listen to him. You don't have to even get along with him. But you're married to him. You can't handle a divorce right now." Jared and Ivanka were gleeful at the prospect of Bannon's ouster. His departure would return the Trump organization to pure family control, the family and its functionaries, without an internal rival for brand meaning and leadership. From the family's point of view, it would also, at least in theory, help facilitate one of the most implausible brand shifts in history, Donald Trump to respectability. The dream, long deferred, of the Trump pivot might actually happen without Bannon. Never mind that this Kushner ideal, saving Trump from himself and projecting Jared and Ivanka into the future, was nearly as far-fetched and extreme as Bannon's own fantasy of a White House dedicated to the return of a pre-1965 American mythology. If Bannon were to go, it also might cause the ultimate split in the already fractured Republican Party. Before the election, one theory suggested that a defeated Trump would take his embittered 35% and make hay with a rancorous minority. Now, the alarming theory was that as Kushner tried to transform his father-in-law into the kind of latter-day Rockefeller that Trump, however implausibly, had on occasion dreamed of becoming, Rockefeller Center being an inspiration for his own real estate branding, Bannon could run off with some meaningful part of that 35%. This was the Breitbart threat. The Breitbart organization remained under the control of the Mercers, and it could at any moment be handed back to Steve Bannon. And now, with Bannon's overnight transformation into political genius and kingmaker, and the triumph of the alt-right, Breitbart was potentially much more powerful. Trump's victory had, in some sense, handed the Mercers the tool with which to destroy him. As push came to shove, and the mainstream media and swamp bureaucracy more and more militantly organized against him, Trump was certainly going to need the Mercer-backed alt-right standing up in his defense. What, after all, was he without them? As the pressure mounted, Bannon, until now absolutely disciplined in his regard for Donald Trump as the ideal avatar of Trumpism and Bannonism, rigidly staying in character as aide and supporter of a maverick political talent, began to crack. Trump, as almost anyone who had ever worked for him appreciated, was, despite what you hoped he might be, Trump. And he would invariably sour on everyone around him. But the Mercers dug in. Without Bannon, they believed the Trump presidency, at least the Trump presidency they had imagined and helped pay for, was over. The focus became how to make Steve's life better. They made him pledge to leave the office at a reasonable time. No more waiting around for Trump to possibly need a dinner companion. Recently, Jared and Ivanka had been heading this off anyway. The solution included a search for a Bannon's Bannon, a chief strategist for the chief strategist. In late March, the Mercers came to an agreed-upon truce with the president. Bannon would not be fired. While this guaranteed nothing about his influence and standing, it did buy Bannon and his allies some time. They could regroup. A presidential aide was only as good as the last good advice he gave, and in this, Bannon believed the ineptness of his rivals, Kushner and his wife, would seal their fate. Though the president agreed not to fire Bannon, he gave Kushner and his daughter something in exchange. He would enhance both their roles. On March 27th, the Office of American Innovation was created, and Kushner was put in charge. Its stated mission was to reduce federal bureaucracy, that is, to reduce it by creating more of it, a committee to end committees. In addition, Kushner's new outfit would study the government's internal technology, focus on job creation, encourage and suggest policies about apprenticeships, enlist business in a partnership with government, and help with the opioid epidemic. It was, in other words, business as usual, albeit with a new burst of enthusiasm for the administrative state. But its real import was that it gave Kushner his own internal White House staff, a team of people working not just on Kushner-supported projects, all largely antithetical to Bannon projects, but more broadly, as Kushner explained to one staffer, on expanding my footprint. Kushner even got his own comms person, a dedicated spokesperson and Kushner promoter. It was a bureaucratic build-out meant not only to enhance Kushner, but to diminish Steve Bannon. 2 days after the announcement about Jared's expanded power base, Ivanka was formally given a White House job, too, advisor to the president. From the beginning, she had been a key advisor to her husband, and he to her. Still, it was an overnight consolidation of Trump family power in the White House. It was, quite at Steve Bannon's expense, a remarkable bureaucratic coup. A divided White House had now all but been united under the president's family. His son-in-law and daughter hoped, they were even confident, that they could speak to DJT's better self, or at least balance Republican needs with progressive rationality, compassion, and good works. Further, they could support this moderation by routing a steady stream of like-minded CEOs through the Oval Office. And indeed, the president seldom disagreed with and was often enthusiastic about the Jared and Ivanka program. If they tell him the whales need to be saved, he's basically for it, noted Katie Walsh. But Bannon, suffering in his internal exile, remained convinced that he represented what Donald Trump actually believed, or more accurately, what the president felt. He knew Trump to be a fundamentally emotional man, and he was certain that the deepest part of him was angry and dark. However much the president wanted to support his daughter and her husband's aspirations, their worldview was not his. As Walsh saw it, Steve believes he is Darth Vader, and that Trump is called to the dark side. Indeed, Trump's fierce efforts to deny Bannon's influence may well have been in inverse proportion to the influence Bannon actually had. The president did not truly listen to anybody. The more you talked, the less he listened. But Steve is careful about what he says, and there is something, a timbre in his voice and his energy and excitement, that the president can really hone in on, blocking everything else out, said Walsh. As Jared and Ivanka were taking a victory lap, Trump signed Executive Order 13783, a change in environmental policy carefully shepherded by Bannon, which, he argued, effectively gutted the National Environmental Policy Act, the 1970 law that served as the foundation of modern environmental protections, and that required all executive agencies to prepare environmental impact statements for agency actions. Among other impacts, EO 13783 removed a prior directive to consider climate change, a precursor to coming debates on the country's position regarding the Paris Climate Accord. On April 3rd, Kushner unexpectedly turned up in Iraq, accompanying General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. According to the White House press office, Kushner was traveling on behalf of the president to express the president's support and commitment to the government of Iraq and U.S. personnel currently engaged in the campaign. Kushner, otherwise a remote and clammed-up media presence, was copiously photographed throughout the trip. Bannon, watching one of the many television screens that provided a constant background in the West Wing, glimpsed Kushner wearing a headset while flying in a helicopter over Baghdad. To no one in particular, recalling a foolish and callow George W. Bush in flight gear on the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln proclaiming the end of the Iraq War, he intoned, "Mission accomplished." Gritting his teeth, Bannon saw the structure of the White House moving in the exact opposite direction from Trumpism-Bannonism. But even now, he was certain he perceived the real impulses of the administration coming his way. It was Bannon, stoic and resolute, the great if unheralded warrior who, at least in his own mind, was destined to save the nation.